The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to John. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern of that is to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. And when the stewards tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." And Jesus did this, the first of his signs in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The Gospel of the Lord. We heard a shortened version of that portion of the letter of Paul to the people of Corinth out of the 12th chapter, and the reason is because if Allison had continued to read, it would have taken us down the rabbit hole of what people refer to as the spiritual gifts. And both Protestants and evangelicals get all excited because this is the definitive list of spiritual gifts in the Bible, which I just need to tell you is total baloney. It's a reference that Paul uses. Baloney, that's an ecclesiastical term, by the way. Right up there with the prayer for prayer shawls and whatnot, where it says, "Bless these prayer shawls and other cool stuff." Other cool stuff, also an ecclesiastical term. Okay. It's baloney because Paul is not, his intent is not to write a list, a definitive list of the spiritual gifts that any one community has access to or embodies. He is writing to a particular people, it's a very small group of people, a small little enclave in the city of Corinth that he established at some point, and he's developed a relationship with these people. And now he continues in his travels, most of which he spends in a jail or a prison. So he's writing to these folks probably out of a prison. And he's heard that they have decided that they're going to use a particular group of spiritual gifts as weapons against each other. And Paul, in his letter to the people of Corinth, is taking umbrage to that. He is arguing against that and saying, folks, that is not the intent of spiritual gifts. And so he's not interested in some definitive list. What he's saying is when we identify gifts that have been given to us by God and we use them to our own purposes, guess what? They're not spiritual gifts anymore. They become self-serving things. But, says Paul, if they are used, and the phrase in Greek is for the common good, when we use the gifts that we've identified that have been given to us by God, and we use them for the common good, oh, poof, they are now spiritual gifts. That's the whole point. It's not a definitive list. So we didn't bother reading it. So there you have it. Now, we come to the fun part of this scene in the Gospel according to John. It's chapter 2. And this scene opens with the words, "And on the third day," and the first question that pops into my little pea brain is, the third day of what? So, go back to chapter 1 and read. Of course, this is John's gospel. This is not Luke, okay? We're back into the gospel according to John. I mean, this is the story where this author and this ancient community is saying, this guy, this Jesus, lives and breathes and has his being at one with the divine. And the overarching invitation of Jesus in John's gospel is, come on in. You know, the Father and I are one, so why don't you come and be one with us? Come on down. And there you have it. And so you go back to the first chapter. It starts with, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word, you know, that beautiful poetic hymnic language that we're familiar with. And then, right in the middle of that prologue, it says, and on the first day, John the Baptist. So, oh, okay, so here's the first day, John the Baptist, out at the Jordan River, and in different fashion, but for similar reasons, as we talked last week, where we discovered that the writer of the Gospel of Luke and that ancient community had a real problem with the idea of Jesus being baptized by John, so they changed the story so that John was imprisoned. You remember that? If you were here last week, he gets imprisoned and then Jesus gets baptized. Ha! Problem solved. Well, here in John, a whole different tack. John appears, sort of comes off the horizon into the center of the story, but he never baptizes Jesus in John's gospel. It becomes a dream sequence. It's as though the author or Jesus has dreamt this moment. And so that's this author's solution to this ancient embarrassment about Jesus being baptized by John. So John's the first day, and then lo and behold, the second day is a couple of guys show up, Philip and Andrew, and they've got one of the overarching questions of the Gospel of John. We want to see. We want to see. So Jesus says, well, come on. Come and see. Again, one of the consistent invitations of John's gospel. And it's an invitation that is issued not just to those ancient ones, but to every generation that follows, right up to our own generation. And so here we are on the third day, and Jesus, there he is in Cana, which is near Nazareth in ancient times, and Mary, who oddly enough is referred to as the mother of Jesus. It's almost like a title in John's gospel. She's not referred to as Mary, but we know her name. She's been invited to a wedding. And the way the story unfolds, the next line, reads in the Greek as though the family who's hosting the wedding says to themselves, oh, geez, we invited Mary. Hi. I guess we have to invite her son. And so Jesus' presence at this wedding is an afterthought, which is kind of funny, but also kind of cool, because then ensues this interesting little conversation between Mary and her son Jesus. And the way it reads in Greek allows a great deal of imagination at this point in the story. In other words, the author is basically saying, I'm not telling you the whole conversation between Mary and Jesus. You fill in the blanks, okay? And so, let's do. Mary says, hey, Jesus, they've run out of wine. And Jesus goes, Ma! I'm not ready. I don't wanna. Ignoring that response, like a good mother would. Mary simply turns to the folks in charge of the wedding and says, do what he tells you. And you can just hear the banter between the two of them going on behind the scenes. I mean, again, the author allows a great deal of imagination there. And so Jesus, he relents. He's like, okay, fine. I mean, I'm not even supposed to be here, Mom. You know, I'm only here because you were invited, because they like you. And so Jesus says, well, you got these big stone jars. I know what they're for the rites of purification. But let's get them filled with water. What do you say? Now, a little aside. These large stone jars, identified by the author as water jars to be used for the rites of purification, contain, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say 30 gallons each, right? Filled to the brim. Six of them, how many gallons is that? 180 gallons of water, right? Now, some biblical scholar who had way too much time on his or her hands did some math, because in the ancient tradition, the rites of purification were not a bath. It was not about bathing. These are a high desert people. They lived in a climate not unlike ours. So water is scarce. I mean, they're constantly looking. Their lives are going to be controlled, their agriculture, everything, by whatever sources of water they can conjure, including from rain. Yay, it happens to be raining today. Quick, collect it. And so the rites of purification would have involved tiny little amounts of water. Again, it's a ritual act of sort of cleansing, you know, in the presence of the divine, recognizing the presence of the divine in all things and all creation, and now we're going to be mindful. There are other cultures who have similar kinds of rites of purification. And so this biblical scholar did the math on this 180 gallons of water and figured that it would supply about 200,000 Jewish people enough water for their rites of purification. That's a lot of people. And it translates into a lot of water. And all of a sudden, armed with that knowledge, and the ancient ones would have known this, as soon as they heard that line, oh, water for the rites of purification, they would have gone, holy smokes, this is going to be epic. I mean, this is huge. And we're already clued in to this notion that whatever's going to happen is going to somehow signify abundance beyond all measure. And so here we go. The water jars are filled. By whom? The slaves? Who might those people have been? Wild guess. Again, use your imagination. Who said women? Yeah. They probably would have been women, because in ancient cultures, and even now among indigenous tribes, who schleps the water from the river to the villages or wherever they happen to be? Who carries the water? The women. So it's probably a group of women, maybe enslaved, you know, maybe they volunteered, but if you've ever carried water, it's extreme. And again, we're not going to bother with the math, but 180 gallons of water, we're talking a whole lot of weight here. So this could take them a while. And the reason I bring this up is because you and I suffer, and the church for centuries has suffered from this fantasy that miracles, or what the writer of the Gospel of John very cautiously refers to not as miracles, but as signs, so sort of drawing us into a different realm of understanding here, that signs happen out of the blue. Poof! Oh, look, it's a miracle! But if you pay attention to every miracle that's ever described in the scriptures, including in any of the gospels, what you discover is that they all involve somebody's work. Somebody's got to work. And in this case, it's a group of women who have to schlep this water that's going to end up being turned into wine. And they have to do their work in order for this to take place. Now, fast forward into the gospel according to John and come to the next scene where a big sign takes place in the sixth chapter, where Jesus is about to issue some big teaching and he's, you know, out with a whole bunch of people, and this huge crowd has gathered around him. The author tells us 5,000, but they only ever counted men. So again, do the math. You could be talking 15, 20,000 people. And at one point, one of Jesus' friends says, probably one of the women, says, all these people are hungry. And guess what Jesus says? Exactly. You feed them. Now, he does this little blessing thing, right? But all of Jesus' friends, who, again, in John's gospel, are not a group of 12 guys, but they are men, they are women, they are children. It's this whole array of people representing a community. They go out among these 15 or 20,000 people, and they feed them. They got to work. Somebody's got to do the work, right? Fast forward again to the 11th chapter. Yet another big sort of pivotal sign in the Gospel of John. Jesus has arrived too late with Mary and Martha, his good friends, and they're all standing outside the tomb of Mary and Martha's brother Lazarus, who has died. He's been dead now for 4 days. And Jesus shows up there and all kinds of stuff goes on. And then the culmination of the story is Jesus says, Lazarus, come forth, come out. But guess what he says before that? He says, you, over there, go roll that stone away. Give me a hand here. I can't do this alone. And somebody's got to do the work. And the whole point, and this is a piece of these ancient stories that we miss when we're not paying attention. So now we are. Somebody's doing the work. And so part of the message, folks, is that you and I get to do our work and then be ready while we're doing our work for the next sign to happen. Not in a vacuum and not poof out of the air, but somehow out of the midst of our lives and the work that you and I have engaged. Does that make sense? It's a little different than, I think, what many of us learned in Sunday school. It's not poof. It's, okay, you and I have some work to do, so let's go about it. So then the question is, what is our work? What's our work? Well, let's break it down. What do you say? And keep it real simple. So some of us, we get up in the morning. Some of us are more bleary than others. Make a cup of coffee or a cup of tea because that's just required. I mean, that's where you got to start, at least in my household. And we hunker down and we say our prayers. It's part of the work. I mean, those of us who get up in the morning and start our day with prayer, we're doing our work. And part of that is to say, okay, help me, I'm here, help me remember that you're with me, with us, you know, enable me to trust, I turn my will and my life over, blah, blah, blah. This is all part of our work, and then we get on with our day, We get involved in situations with other people and find all kinds of opportunities to sort of tell the truth about ourselves. Oh, hey, I screwed up. Let me make this right. You know, we tell the truth about ourselves. That's part of our work. And then as we go through the course of the day, we're looking for opportunities to be of service. Give me 2 minutes. You know, if I'm alert, if I'm awake, I'll find that opportunity to be available to someone or to some situation. That's part of our work. And if we're going through the day like that, you and I are doing our work. And then, you know, it can get really fancy. I mean, that's the sort of baseline there. If we continue on with our work, it will involve things like listening. Do you know how hard it is to listen? I do. I mean, one of the things my spiritual director in the early days came at me over and over and over and over again, enough so that now I have his voice sort of rolling through my head on a regular basis. And what he would say to me regularly is, now, ask the question, and here's the key, wait for the answer.
What?
I mean, I'm really good at asking questions, but I've really got to be in the zone to be able to wait for the answer to the question. Right? Hey, how are you? So listening may be an enormous part of our daily work. And any of you who have participated so far in the training sessions for getting a community organization going in Northern Nevada, modeled after what they're doing in the South with Nevadans for the Common Good, you already know that the core of the work of organizing any community is listening. It's called one-on-one interviews, asking questions and listening for the answer. And you begin community organizing with listening, and it ends with listening as well. And so this has got to be also a huge part of our work. And then there's the day-to-day stuff that we do. I mean, and what are some of us are showing up at work. Some of us are retired but attending to other people. Some of us are caregivers. Some of us are in need of care, which is also part of our work. Think of all the things that you do over the course of the day. All of this is our work given to us by God. And so the key to participating in this invitation that Jesus issues when he says, hey, I'm the Father of one, come on in, you can be one with us as well, is to get up out of bed every day, suit up, and do our work. And then sort of be expectant. And it's in that way, with everyone doing their work, that these signs and wonders take place. The miracles, if you will. What do you think of them apples? One of the things that I have come to admire and love about St. Peter's as a community is that when push comes to shove, we're willing to do our work. And that's all it takes, is willingness. And then in the midst of that, the signs and the wonders and the miracles happen. So, take a moment. Take a nice deep breath. And let's get about our work.